On July 6th, 1902, the New York Times published a fascinating article titled The Future of Reading. After reporting Jules Verne's prediction that novels would be supplanted by newspapers and popular reading culture, the editors voiced their concern in a passage that is worth quoting at length. "We cannot imagine our grandchildren wading through files of old papers for the sake of the same kind of entertainment as we receive from historical romances. Nor, whatever may be the course of journalistic development, can we believe that they will find in the morning paper of their time a complete satisfaction of those instinctive cravings which drove their ancestors to James and Howells." The incidents reported in a single issue of a morning paper doubtless supply as many thrills as we could get from 400 or 500 pages of a sensational novel, and there is much to be learned about the comedy and tragedy of human existence from the plain record of a selection of the happenings of 24 hours. But all of this comes to us in a succession of jerks. We get merely a series of snapshots at life. There is no evolution of its mysterious drama. Hi, I'm Michael Roberts, and welcome to the Tsugma Podcast, sponsored by the DWRL at the University of Texas at Austin. In today's debut episode, we will be examining the intersections of rhetoric and technology as they appear in one of the most basic language technologies, reading. Like the Times editors from a century ago, many people today find our encounters with words in flux. For better or worse, newspapers no longer pose the threat they once did. Instead, we find ourselves barraged with words that would have sounded strange in 1902. Blogs and Kindles, Google and iPads. Is print dying? And if so, what will happen to reading? How does toggling between internet tabs change the way we think about reading? How does crowdsourcing? Our episode today encounters many different viewpoints on the future of reading, but all of them agree that, like a century ago, developing technologies are changing the ways that we think about reading. First, my co-podcasters Hala and Lisa discuss the already famous, or infamous, essay on technology and reading practices, Nicholas Carr's Is Google Making Us Stupid?, from the Atlantic Monthly in 2008. Second, I interview Bob Stein, a founder of the Criterion Collection and the founder and director of the Institute for the Future of the Book. And finally, Eric Detweiler documents his experiences and observations on virtual reading and writing communities in an audio essay. Welcome to the Tsugma Podcast and enjoy the show.
I'm Paula.
And I'm Lisa.
This section is called TLDR. TLDR, which is internet slang. What is it?
Too long, didn't read.
Too long, didn't read. We both kind of know what it is, but we did some research on it. I found the Wikipedia page for TLDR.
Of course.
And it's very long, and it has a TLDR summary.
It does.
Yeah.
Its summary being be concise.
Yeah. So it opens up with a quotation from Blaise Pascal, who's a 17th century French mathematician, philosopher, and it's from his provincial letters, and it's at the end of one of his letters, which is rather long, and he says, "I've made this letter longer than usual because I lack the time to make it short."
And we kind of saw that as a precursor to the TLDR summaries now.
So it's like an admission of, like, I kind of went off on a tangent and wrote too much, and I don't know if you want to read all of this.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's sort of the way people use TLDR. It can be a little mean, but it's, yeah, basically saying, like, you're being a little selfish with your time. This is too long. I'm not going to read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cutting them down to size a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people will write really long comments and then TLDR themselves and have like a little...
Which is very reflective.
Yeah.
It's knowing that you did write a long post and people might not have enough patience or time.
So that's what TLDR is. And that's, I guess, kind of what the theme of this podcast is, too.
And it's actually kind of the problem with internet reading, according to certain scholars, like Nicholas Carr, for example.
Right. This article is Google Making Us Stupid.
First, let's talk about what this article actually argues.
Yeah.
Is Google making us stupid? The answer is probably, according to Nicholas Carr, yes. It's kind of making us stupid.
He says, immersing myself in a book or a lengthy article used to be easy. My mind would get caught in the narrative or the turns of the argument, and I'd spend hours strolling through long stretches of prose. Now my concentration starts to drift after two or three pages. It's not just something that he's argued, right? Other people have argued it.
It's true, yeah.
So he thinks that Google is making our attention spans shorter and making us more distracted and unable to concentrate because the internet, not just Google, provides us with an abundance of information.
Yes.
So that keeps us from
focusing too deeply on one topic or on one text.
Yeah, because Google changes the way that we experience it, or the internet in general changes the way that we experience time. We are interested in the claim that that new advances in technology actually make time move faster, seem to move faster. Mm-hmm. We're a little suspicious of that position because anytime any kind of new technology is introduced, right, people kind of get panicky about it.
The get off my lawn kind of people.
Yeah. And, you know, this is new, I don't understand it. And I mean, just from my own research, like, I know that people freaked out about the novel, for instance, and how that's like a mode of reading and a mode of engagement that, I mean, they thought it was like dangerous for your brain, like they thought it would rot your mind.
Yeah, because it was all fun and game, but it wasn't introspective,
right.
It wasn't...
It's like a narrative for entertainment, which like people thought was really dangerous.
Yes. The original reaction, the initial reaction is, wow, we're scared of this entertainment.
Right. And, you know, I mean, you see the same thing with, like, video games, right? Like, the same question, are video games making us dumb, you know?
Or violent. I mean, yeah, there's always been a pushback against different technologies.
Right. And I think that by now, like, at least with, you know, with novels and even with video games, we are kind of aware that those things can sometimes change the way you think, but whether it's for the better or for the worse, like, depends largely on the person, depends on the way they engage, and just depends on what you take from it, right?
And in fact, we can kind of make the argument that time is at a standstill in certain respects when it comes to the internet. Because we are getting updated by people that are in far places, that people who aren't in your same town or in the same country, but that you feel emotionally close with, you're able to get their real-time updates and kind of be in their present. It feels as if the time that you have spent away from each other is shorter or is in fact not non-existent.
Right.
Because you're always in each other's lives.
Yeah, it's like less vast. Actually, that reminded me of like, so maybe you have this experience too. I mean, I have relatives in the Middle East and there's like stuff going on there. And it's interesting to get, like, there's, I think on the Guardian website, you can get live updates of things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting just to think about, like, okay, right now, over there, it's in the middle of the night, you know, what's going on? I mean, it makes you aware of different, I guess, just in the sense of time zones, right?
Mm-hmm.
It makes you aware of different experiences of time and how drastically they can differ from yours. The internet can introduce you to a different experience of time, can make that accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Let's, like, explore the idea that it's making time move faster. So where does that come from?
The sense of urgency, especially with the constant updates. If you want to keep up with what's going on in the world or what's going on with even your friends, you know, you're constantly refreshing your page, or the page is refreshing for you.
Right.
Just live like updates. With Twitter. Yeah. Live updating.
Or Facebook. You know, like what's going on with this person.
The
right
news
now.
Feed.
Right.
Yeah.
The news.
The feed, which is an interesting word itself. I mean, it's kind of... We're kind of consuming these updates in a way that is kind of piggish in a way. Horrible.
Right. Too much, right?
Yeah, too much. But so is that forcing us then to feel a sense of urgency, the constant updates, the trying to keep up with what's going on?
Right. And does it make us impatient to, say, for example, sit down and read like a long
too long didn't
thing,
read?
Yeah.
And if time is moving faster, is it more likely that we are not going to read longer pieces of text because they become obsolete? Is that part of
like,
the argument?
Oh, that blog post was like from a week ago. Yeah.
So 10 minutes
ago. Yeah, that's old news. But yeah, I mean, with something like, for example, like gossip websites or something, you're not going to want to read like last week's gossip, right? Like
that's true.
Sort of thing.
Yeah, it's already old news.
Yeah, it's like very topical and very, you know, very dependent. Its value is dependent on time.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things on the internet where...
They're not based on time. So just like the Google Books corpus,
right?
There are all these books. In fact, we just looked out the Blaise Pascal quote. We went and looked at the original book it was in, and we found it on Google Books, and yeah. I could spend hours on it if I wanted to. And that's different. You know, it's not based on updating, so I'm not going to Google Books every day and saying, what's the newest book I could download? It's a little different.
You could see time as moving faster online, mm-hmm. right? Your perception of time can move faster. If you seek out things that are more immersive, I guess, or slower, like mm-hmm. you can find slower media, quote unquote, right? Like a book on Google Books, and if you seek that out, you can get.
And in fact, if we're looking at this page on Google Books right now, and there's nothing on it that is getting updated.
Yeah.
There's nothing on it that's changing. There's nothing on here that is in fact distracting me.
So well, then let's sort of segue into talking about deep reading, deep thinking, deep stuff.
It's all deep.
All right. So Nicholas Carr mentions this briefly in his article mm-hmm. in terms of he's afraid that the internet is making our perception of time move faster. He's also afraid that because our perception of time is speeding up, that we're less able to deeply engage with media, whether it's on the internet or whether it's a book or wherever it is.
Let's talk about the Wikipedia black holes right. that we can go down.
I remember I went on a tea binge once. Not a literal binge, but like I read about like mm-hmm. every kind of tea. I figured out what Lapsang Souchong is and
nice.
All these different things.
We're on a complete tangent. This is probably the internet's fault.
Everything is.
Let's get back to that immersion in the Wikipedia experience.
Right.
So we were
talking about Wikipedia mm-hmm. as a way to talk about immersion is because it's an easy way to kind of get lost mm-hmm. in the internet mm-hmm. and to kind of read.
And in fact, there are all these communities, not just Wikipedia, but Wikipedia being one of them, mm-hmm. communities of people who decide to really delve deeply into one topic. I was watching Battlestar Galactica and The Wire, The Wire recently and Battlestar a couple years ago. Uh-huh. But when I wanted to look something up about the characters or I wanted to look something up about the costume choices,
right.
I would just go on the internet and there would be these portals where I'd be transported into this world.
And you can only imagine how painstaking and how time-consuming that must mm-hmm. be, right?
Mm-hmm.
To make it and then people go read it and probably spend forever on it.
Yeah. The person who made it had to have read themselves. You know, they had to have read that episode and right. looked at all the different things going on there and yeah. kind of compiled all this information for us to read. There are these moments of immersion definitely on the internet. Nicholas Carr's argument is based on the immersion that we have in the internet being itself a distraction from something bigger and better and greater.
It's like kind of all about how you use it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So potentially it could be a distraction or it could be this amazing, interesting thing where you delve so deeply into right. a topic. I don't think he sees that deep kind of diving into right. researching a topic or getting into that world
yeah.
as being a positive thing.
And I mean, a lot of my research happens on the internet and mm-hmm. I can get pretty into it.
Again, and it's following these paths and going on an adventure, finding an article and seeing who else they cited. You just go on these tangents, but sometimes take you to a wonderful immersive place,
right.
a deep thinking kind of place.
So it's not bad, it's just different.
That is really his argument, is that it's changing our way of thinking.
And he seems like anxious about it, mm-hmm. but doesn't hesitate to say that it's bad, but it seems like other people.
I mean, he ends his article with Hal saying,
oh,
I can feel
yeah,
it, I can feel it, I'm
right.
afraid.
Right,
in
so this
that,
is Hal, the robot
machine.
From
yeah.
2001 A Space Odyssey.
Stop there. I'm afraid.
I mean, he brings up the fact that he's more human in terms of feeling than the other actual human characters.
And that's, I guess, a risk. That's like his worst case scenario,
yeah.
right? That like people become robotic and
yes.
unfeeling.
But when you get like a status update from your baby sister who just had
yeah.
like an amazing day, I feel pretty happy.
And you can like definitely express emotions
yeah.
and connect with other people on the internet.
Yeah, and read things that they've posted that you would never have been able to find yourself. The sharing of information too is pretty amazing. Speaking of sharing, yeah, we will have a podcast, an episode on sharing. Watch out for it. All right, see you later.
All right, bye.
Bye.
This is Michael Roberts at the Zugma Podcast, and we are delighted to have Bob Stein with us today. He is the founder of the Criterion Collection, an important innovator slash developer of the CD-ROM in the 1980s, and the founding director of the Institute for the Future of the Book, which is, as the title might suggest, invested in the future of book reading, reading technologies. And so we're delighted to have you on the podcast.
Nice to be here.
So I guess my first question, I just kind of want to piggyback off of the talk that you gave last night, or the roundtable you were part of last night, when you said, and to, sorry to poorly paraphrase you, but you said something that in the past, maybe even as recently as a century ago, that people were not as invested as they are today in kind of like permanence or authority, especially when it comes to books or reading, and that probably in the future that that will also be the case. Some people will look on today as strangely obsessed with things being with a kind of permanence, especially a permanence of the word. Is that correct?
Or? Yeah, well, the timing's a little bit off. People's interest in authority really arises with print. The reality is that especially in a post-World War II era.
Right, you said something, like especially, there's something about like middle class, Western,
well, you know, the first time this occurred to me, I was sitting in a friend's flat in London, and he's a journalist, and it was one of these beautiful rooms with four walls of books, wall to wall, ceiling to floor to ceiling. And I realized that that sight, which wasn't unfamiliar to me, of living amongst a library, mm-hmm. was something that was completely unusual until post-World War II for middle-class people, right? Because
right.
When books were all hardback and, you know, cloth-bound and expensive, middle-class people couldn't assemble personal libraries of that scope. And then suddenly we could. So, you know, those of us who are interested in these questions, we are all intellectuals. We all do have personal libraries. You know, we go to elite institutions that have fantastic libraries of, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of books. So this idea that there's a permanence to our culture is something that's so deeply embedded in us. But it's not human, you know, it's not embedded in the human species.
It's not always been there.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's something almost curatorial, I guess, about reading when you can just, like, collect, you can collect all your favorite books and then you kind of, you own them, you know, you have books. I guess it is interesting that when you don't have something so physical and material that you don't have as much kind of control. On one hand, you have infinite control because you can have anything at any point, but there's also not something where you can, like, build up a library, since the library is everything all the time.
Yeah, but the problem, though, with seeing it that way is that you're pretty much at the we are pretty much at the beginning of a transition. And the reality is that, I mean, for example, when the walls of a room like this are screens, and the books aren't just sort of spying out, but all the media in your life is there on the walls. You know, like when you go to somebody's house and, you know, I don't know if you're like, I'm like me, if I go to somebody's house that I've never been to before, the first thing I do is I go look in their bookcase. I used to go look at their record collection. Of course, that's not there anymore because it's all in their iPods.
Right, it's all become digital.
Right.
Yeah.
But the bookshelves are still there. But that's going to come back, right? You're going to be able to walk into somebody's house.
And still do that.
And you're going to see everything. You know, Spotify is actually a very interesting example. Spotify has become my radio, my DJ. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, a dozen friends of quite different and eclectic tastes, and what I listen to basically is what I glean from browsing what they're listening to. And if, you know, in a lot of ways, half of the newspaper articles I read every day are ones which friends on Facebook have posted, right? And so I think that the curatorial aspect of future media is way, way more interesting than right now.
Yeah, I think you're right on in saying that. I think it is going to be more important. Like reading, consuming media is going to be that filters or curators are going to become more and more important. I think a good example is the Criterion Collection, which you know, originally, I think a lot of the developments that you were part of were had to do with adding commentary and like some of those more digital aspects. But I think one of the main appeals as it's gone on has been kind of that curatorial aspect. And partially, I think what's popular about it, what gives it cultural cachet, is that there's a limited number of titles, right? And so you can just assume that if the Criterion Collection is working on it, that it's going to be something that is worth seeing, right? It's not just, they're not just releasing, it's not a depository of all video where you, but people can just kind of learn about new movies by just looking at the list of the Criterion Collection. And so I think that's interesting that that's, some of those things are not so much about breadth of access, but almost like narrowness of access. It's ways to limit your experience because there's going to be so much out there with new reading.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that gets for me to one of the really interesting questions about the future of reading, which is that I'm not a man of predictions in terms of timing, but I did say in 2007 I wrote something that said that within 10 years some university would give a degree in reading and that there was going to be a new class of a new professional class which would be people who read for a living. You know, it's very interesting. The blog is short for weblog, and weblogs were originally amateurs basically seeing something on the web, putting it onto their weblog and telling their friends about it. And so I would say that was a function of reading. And then somehow writers came along and hijacked the weblog and turned it into a mechanism for
for
basically putting their ideas out there.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that with such an endless cornucopia of stuff, the need for people to filter that and to curate that and to, you know, not only say this is good but why it's good just becomes increasingly important. And so I'm quite sure that we're going to see the rise of sort of the professional editor, curator, reader.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of leads me to my second question, which is, I think that reading practices today, especially if you consider that I think most reading that young people do today is going to be on a screen, some kind of websites, usually with multiple tabs open or multiple screens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a result of this, many nostalgic critics kind of have been like bemoaning this change in reading culture. And, you know, they're citing things like Twitter as kind of like reducing people's concentration abilities. There's that famous article, Why Google is Making Us Stupid, from
Nick Carr.
Yeah. And I just, you know, you describe reading socially across many threads. Last night you talked about people being able to not only read Gulliver's Travels or whatever, but also your friend's comments on it, or being able to, or, you know, Google other things. Do you see this new kind of reading, or, you know, this kind of like multitasking reading, as any kind of threat or obstacle to what we've called, you know, like might call close reading?
Part of the problem here is that you have the book and, you know, this N-hundred pages of expository text. And to really get at that, the only way up until now has been for us to curl ourselves up, you know, by ourselves and read it and think about it. And that's how people understand, you know, that's how things have moved forward for the last many hundreds of years. But what we're getting back to is, or where we're going is a sort of a new synthesis where you're going to be able to do both. You're going to be able to think by yourself, but you're going to be able to flip all kinds of different switches and suddenly be in a group think, in a hive mind. And I have absolutely no doubt that multiple perspectives on a problem is going to, in the long run, get us way further than individual. I mean, the reality is that the printing gives rise to the idea of the individual genius.
I guess because for me personally, I'm not nostalgic about books or anything, but I think I might be nostalgic about, for the example, reading something very difficult. Say, okay, I'm going to have to read Hegel or something, really, you know, and just sitting through a book and just having the book and just like being forced to concentrate on that. Whereas I think if I were reading Hegel today on a computer or an ebook, I would probably be linking all the time to Wikipedia pages on the definition of things. And I think I would learn a lot around Hegel. I think I would be going off in tangents a lot more instead of just having to struggle through something like a very complex reason of thought. Does that make
sense?
Yeah,
but actually I'll argue probably the opposite, which is I don't think you'll learn a lot more around Hegel. I think you'll learn a lot more about Hegel. I mean, you know, I'll give you a good example for me. Ulysses. I'll believe that I could get something out of reading it, but I actually don't have much confidence. And I'm waiting. I'm getting old, but, you know, I trust it'll happen sooner rather than later. I'm waiting for the fully annotated
ebook
version of it, which, where I get multiple annotations from different points of view, where I have the audio because it's a book that needs to be heard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I think your example of Hegel is sort of perfect because Hegel is dense, Hegel is complicated. My problem when I read something like that is not that I can't wrestle with it, but I have no confidence that I'm actually understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I need to go to the Wikipedia and to the...
Look up this term or look up...
And to see how three different people, you know, parsed it, and then to try to understand it from that. You know, this idea that we've got to do it on our own, it's just silly at this point. I get it. I understand where it comes from, but I don't... It's just even the way you spoke about it, it was as if you've got to, that the mark of learning is suffering.
Yeah, there's something almost masochistic about it.
You know, the reality is it should be like play, and it can be. That's the interesting thing, is that when you start to give yourself up into these sort of new modalities of reading and learning, something that actually I think was ridiculously unsatisfying and hard suddenly can become fun.
All right, well, I think that's about all the time we have, but thank you, Bob Stein. You've made me feel a lot more optimistic, a lot. You made me excited and maybe even utopian about the future of reading.
Great. Thank you.
I have to start with a confession. I really, really enjoy the TV show Pretty Little Liars. The show follows four high school girls who, in the wake of the disappearance and death of a mutual friend named Allison, come together to fight back against a mysterious blackmailer who may or may not be their friend's murderer.
Allie? She's gone.
I think I heard her scream.
Somebody left a note in my locker.
From A?
They found her friend.
I knew she was back. Is she inside?
Emily, we found Allison's body.
Oh my God,
I'm still here.
And I know everything. A.
And this isn't Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Friday Night Lights, one of those shows with inexhaustible thematic depth or allegories about some existential condition lurking under its pretty characters and high school veneer. That's not to say it's a bad show, but it is at least four parts Gossip Girl.
You know you love me. XOXO.
For every one part Twin Peaks.
The owls are not what they seem.
Though there is some undeniably creepy small-town depravity going on. As an English teacher, though, I have my qualms with the show. For one thing, these girls almost never do homework, and almost never read. Sure, you'll occasionally see them cracking To Kill a Mockingbird or Great Expectations, but only for a few seconds at the beginning of a scene, before life or some threat to life inevitably interrupts them. Actually, to say they never read is unfair, because life frequently interrupts them in the form of a text message.
Oh my God.
Kids these days, right? With their tweets and texts and Tumblrs. But what about Twain's and Tolstoy's and Toni Morrison's? Now, I should be honest here. I've heard that last complaint quite a few times, but I'm suspicious about claims that Johnny can't read, or Janelle can't write, or that the genres in which they are reading and writing are inherently stupid or superficial. If you think reading text messages can't require incredibly complex acts of rhetorical analysis, just try exchanging a few with my 18-year-old sister. A lot of kids these days are reading quite a bit, no matter what violence the things they're reading do to traditional grammar and punctuation. And considering we're now seeing novels and reading apps designed specifically for smartphones, you start wondering how much our frustrations might echo those of an old monk who just caught a young brother reading a book from a printing press. Some of the things kids read may be brief, may be abbreviated, but some of them are complex, mysteriously complex. Take something like The Amanda Project. Launched by the teen division of Harper Publishers, The Amanda Project billed itself as the first collaborative, interactive fiction series for girls. The plot, if you can call it that, is similar to Pretty Little Liars, or, again, a sort of Twin Peaks light. A young girl named Amanda has disappeared. A community of friends and interested parties come together to investigate her disappearance. In this case, however, instead of being scripted by a team of TV writers, members of this site are highly involved in writing and unfolding the mystery. And the writings of these anonymous participants suggest some incredibly observant and thoughtful readers, as they read and reflexively write themselves into the mystery as characters. They pick apart detail after detail, speculating at length about the significance of objects, characters, turns of phrase. As a rhetoric instructor, I spend whole semesters trying to get students to focus not just on nitpicking grammatical errors in their peers' writing, but on the logical progression of ideas, on transitions, on the use of evidence in argument. And here on the Amanda Project are a bunch of girls, apparently age 13 and up, already doing just that. Of course, I can think of at least two ready objections here. The first is that the sort of composition and analysis these young writers are engaged in is a sort of gushy form of writing that privileges self-expression rather than rigor and reflection. In writing pedagogy, this was the sort of objection that was driven into the ground in critiques of the so-called expressivist movement of the 1980s and 90s. Suffice it to say, I'd be more amenable to these critiques if the writing on many sites like the Amanda Project wasn't so highly responsive and dialogic. Clearly these writers aren't, well, at least aren't just, realizing themselves or squeezing their solipsistic hearts onto the digital page. There's a high sense of community awareness happening here. The other objection has to do with the sponsor of the Amanda Project, Harper Teen. After publishing a series of 8 young adult novels spun off of the Amanda Project, the Harper team promptly abdicated the website, wrapped it in plastic, and moved on to new projects. Something doesn't smell quite right. Whiffs of corporate opportunism, perhaps? That the site was just a cynical marketing tool designed to increase book sales by developing an especially engaged target audience? Or a chance to conduct a surreptitious extended focus group? One gets paranoid. Was there a team of audience analysts perusing the comment threads?
Jim, they seem to like characters whose names start with A. Decrease intertextual references to Hermione from Harry Potter. Repeat, Hermione is on the way out.
A likely story, but still, something's happening here. Even with the disappearance of the Amanda Project, this sort of collaborative writing continues all over the internet. This is nothing new, of course. The Surrealists had their exquisite corpses, collaborative compositions passed from author to author. But online spaces seem to have afforded a particularly inventive forum for written collaborations. Fanfiction communities, collaborative poetry, and let's not forget that non-fictional collaboration par excellence, Wikipedia, where the entry on collaborative fiction notes the use educational organizations like the 826 Project have made of community writing projects. Disappointingly, the same Wikipedia entry has a section entitled Academic Perspectives and Projects that's remarkably dour, and I quote, From an academic perspective, there is anxiety about collaborative authorial endeavors. Academics are concerned with being able to discover who wrote what and which ideas belong to whom. Specifically, in the humanities, collaborative authorship has been frowned upon in favor of the individual author. End quote. Not necessarily a comprehensive statement, but noteworthy given the commonplaces it assumes and reasserts about academics' attitudes. Traditional attitudes toward plagiarism, toward appropriation, toward collaborative reading and writing practices that make the genealogy of ideas hard to trace. All these may bespeak anxiety that some serious trauma might be necessary to shake academics in the humanities out of their allergy to collaborative reading practices. Perhaps we need the disappearance of someone whose name begins with A. Or perhaps such a thing has already occurred. Harper Teen has its vanished Amanda. Pretty Little Liars has the absent Allison. And we, as the autopsy reports have been telling us for a few decades now, have a dead, capital A author on our hands. Perhaps the mystery has already begun. Going to do it for this episode of Zoogma. Special thanks to Bob Stein and to the Texas Institute for Literary and Textual Studies, which brought him to UT's campus for its symposium on the fate of the book. For more information on Stein, the Institute, Zoogma, and the Digital Writing and Research Lab, check out our website at zoogma.dwrl.utexas.edu. That's zeugma.dwrl.utexas.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Zoogma Podcast. This week's episode was produced by Michael Roberts and co-produced by Eric Detweiler. As Hala and Lisa mentioned, check back on February 5th for our next episode, which will focus on sharing. Thanks for listening.